In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with one of America's best-known historians of religion. His name is Martin Marty. He is Fairfax Cone Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of the History of Modern Christianity at the Divinity School of the University of Chicago. He is the author of over 50 books, including the three-volume Modern American Religion, published by the University of Chicago Press. He is the George B. Caldwell Senior Scholar in Residence at the Park Ridge Center for the Study of Health, Faith, and Ethics. He's contributing editor of The Christian Century and editor of the newsletter Context. He is visiting the campus of the University of Illinois and will be giving the 11th annual Mortensen Distinguished Lecture this afternoon at 4 o'clock. This takes place in the Colwell Playhouse of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The main sponsor here is the Mortensen Center for International Library Programs. This is an organization that's interested in building ties among libraries and librarians around the world for the promotion of international peace, education, and understanding. To this date, more than 500 librarians from 75 countries have taken part in programs of the Mortensen Center. Also, this is an event in the MillerCom series. So, as is the case with all these programs, they're free and open to the public, and anyone who is interested here in and around Champaign-Urbana should feel welcome to attend the lecture at 4 o'clock this afternoon. We're also very pleased that Dr. Marty can be here and talk with us so that all of these people who are not here in Champaign-Urbana can also have the opportunity to hear from him. As we talk, questions and comments certainly are welcome. All we ask of people listening is that people try to be brief just so we can keep things moving along and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, thank you very much, Professor Marty, for being here. We're very pleased you could be here.
Glad to be here.
You were involved. You were the director of a project that was undertaken by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, a multi-year project which resulted in a multi-volume study report talking about fundamentalist religious movements around the world.
Yes.
And I fear this is a dangerous question to ask because it's such a big question, but can you talk a little bit about what you feel you learned, you and your colleagues who were involved, had learned?
By studying fundamentalisms in 23 religions, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Sikhism, and all the rest, we did learn that every religion has its vast majority of moderate, faithful people, and it has a counterforce, usually very small and usually quite militant, that draws on different parts of the ancient texts or events. We learn all kinds of things. One thing we wouldn't have noticed if we hadn't compared is that all 23 of them portray themselves as being the old-time religion, and all 23 of them are extremely at home in the modern world. They're really modern movements, and they use the modern technology, tape recorders for the Ayatollah, television for American fundamentalist evangelists, the weaponry for the Gush Emunim in Israel and Taliban forces, etc. I think that was interesting. I don't think it occurred to us that all 23 of them are extremely male-centered. God is very masculine and macho, and the human race is supposed to be run on models of that. So things like this would show up. Now, at the same time, the last thing I'll say now is we also stressed how different they are from each other. So if we have an American Protestant fundamentalist listening, I hope he isn't thinking that we're saying they're like them. That's not the point. We stressed how different they were. We listened with tape recording. We let them define their own movements their own way. Our whole study would have been useless had it not been fair-minded, and I think the people studied found they're fair-minded. So the purpose of studying them in common was to see what leaps out at you in their externals, not in their core.
I think it's important to acknowledge, as you do when you talk about fundamentalisms, that we are not talking about one thing. We are talking about a multifaceted phenomenon. But having said that, the question that has been raised, when we see people like this coming forward in many different religious traditions, all within, it seems, a relatively short period of time, mm-hmm. then one wants to ask, well, why at this time have we seen this happen in different places and different traditions? What seems to be going on that has inspired this?
That's a good question. We did not study historic conservatisms like the Protestant Reformation or medieval Catholicism. We didn't study orthodoxies like Orthodox Jews. We didn't study traditionalisms like High Church Episcopalians. We studied movements that rose after people thought there'd not be any more like that. That is, the first thing that had to happen was the assaults of modernity, however defined, could come in a lot of different ways. And most of these movements started, American Protestant versions in the 1920s, the Muslim Brotherhood, which has some backing behind what we're seeing today, founded in 1928. That's when the first wave of this hit. Radio came. The world got smaller. People start studying in other countries and bringing their customs and so on. And so the key word in all we studied always turned out to be all these movements are reacting against something. They think they're protecting the old way of life by reacting, and they almost always overreact. But these forces came. And then they came again in the 1970s, 80s, with the rise of the new technologies again, globalization of markets, of ethics, etc. And I think the end of the Cold War meant that a lot of forces that had been invisible and suppressed by Soviet totalitarianism and everything else had their chance to sprout and flower and become visible and bid for power in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a call or two bringing to the conversation. I think I will do that rather than make them wait. Other people who are listening are welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'd like to ask Dr. Marty if he could think of he's just cited some historical dates, but a historical precedent for our disaster of the present, and also some words to live by at this time and in what obviously will be other stressful times following up to this emergency. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Probably in all of history, there are terrorist movements, but this usually means a little band of people come over the hill with slingshots and bow and arrow and then go back having destroyed things. I think what's qualitatively different in the current version that makes it hard to say precedent is in the change in weaponry, that people in many nations can be in touch with each other and plan things together, that you can use gases and airplanes and so many kinds of instruments of this sort has meant that what used to be, as I described it, a few people coming over the hill at you or subverting and blowing up one house now are capable of impinging on whole civilizations. And I don't think we can ever lean back with security the same way we did. You wanted some little advice. I don't know if I'm a good advisor. I would say we have to be extremely discriminating. I think any time an American who is not a Muslim turns to any of the 7 million American Muslims and thinks they're part of it and acts that way, you're playing indeed into the hands of the terrorists. That's exactly what they'd like to have happen and confirm. I think if we disrupt everything in our way of life and roll over and play dead and make no moves that aren't in the general pattern of keeping our homes, families, jobs, ways of life, recreation healthy, we're playing into it. I think in the patriotic sphere, I think if we start judging everybody, if they don't shout quite as loudly as we do in anger or wave the flag quite as strenuously as we, if we think they're not as patriotic, I think that's a great flaw. I think we're getting some positives in that we have pulled together. We've seen awesome heroism in the firemen, the police, the chaplaincies that are on the scene in New York. There are great strengths on which to rely. But that would be the first family of things I think we should watch. Again, I'm not a military expert, so I'm not going to give them advice, but I'm talking about what the civilian and the citizen can do at the very beginning.
Shortly after the attack, a very prominent American religious leader said he thought that God had allowed this to happen because God was mad at us. For those people of faith who believe God does not work that way, how does one think about this?
Good question. I've talked to reporters in several cities. I report on reporters in the religious field. Los Angeles Times, the Fort Worth newspaper, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel today. I've watched the New York Times, USA Today, Washington Post, who covered sermons the way they've never covered sermons for many, many years, because sermons are one of the close-to-the-ground things. They say overwhelmingly they're done very responsibly. And I think the first responsible thing to say is by the best-known preacher in America, who hasn't a perfect record on these things, but he sure did it right the other day when Billy Graham was asked precisely that question, what's God doing? And he said, I have to be an honest man. I ask that question often in my life. I don't know. And I think when the clergy get up and say that, it's a much better protection for the people over against that impulse that every move we make, God legitimates, and every move they make, Satan legitimates. That's the way they talk. We shouldn't talk that way. That doesn't mean that if you are a believer, there's no discernment of the hand of God in history. My own approach here is following Reinhold Niebuhr wrote a great book 50 years ago called The Irony of American History, in which no matter what you do, something's going to go wrong, and you're partly an agent of it. And he says, therefore, you have to act on your knowledge, but you have to know there's ignorance going with it. You have to act on your innocence, but you know there's guilt under it. You have to act with your virtues, but you have to know there's vice within it. You have to act with your security, but you know there are insecurities within it. And there's just enough of that that'll always fall back upon you. But he said, and this is very much the spirit of Abraham Lincoln, the other great theological ironist in American history, the Almighty has his own purposes and we're not controlling them. As Lincoln said, both sides pray to the same God, both read the same Bible, both want to win, both can't. You should try to discern the mysterious will of God. And when Niebuhr has said that things will go wrong, he doesn't say, therefore, be passive. He says, he liked to quote Psalm 2, verse 4, when the nations get too uppity, God who sits in the heavens laughs at them and holds them in derision. He says, we don't say that in order to be cynical or passive or apathetic or let ourselves be victims. He says the same God who says that also holds us responsible and honors human aspiration. And at their best, I think the clergy and the lay leadership are trying to get that idea across to their people as we prosecute whatever kind of prosecution we're going to be doing in the seasons ahead.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Martin Marty. He is Professor Emeritus of the History of Modern Christianity at the Divinity School, University of Chicago, and has written a lot about religion in America, other matters of faith. He's the author of over 50 books, has been, over the years, widely interviewed, and we're pleased that he could be here with us. He's here on the campus of the university to give a talk. This is the 11th annual Mortensen Distinguished Lecture. I'll be talking this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Caldwell Playhouse at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. And anyone who is listening who is in and around Champaign-Urbana is certainly welcome to attend. And we have another caller here, so why don't we talk with them? Line number one, they're in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to comment that and raise this point with you, too, that among the largest Muslim nations, Indonesia, for example, there's these same fundamentalist movements going against their democratic government, and the same is true in Malaysia. And I think we need to remember that this is not a Muslim versus non-Muslim issue.
That's a good point. I think we often forget in America that there are more Muslims in the non-Arab world than in the Arab world. Indonesia is the third or fourth most populous nation in the world, and largely Muslim, with great numbers of varieties of peoples there, and they have this. I think the second thing to remember, and I'm glad you brought that up, is in most places where you've had militant and then sometimes terrorist fundamentalist movements, the main enemy for them starts being their own government, their own polity. The Muslim world and the Southeast Asian world have many nations in which the leadership are not maybe democratic after our model as we'd see it, but there's some openness, there's some diversity. They are often relaxedly Muslim. They sometimes may be military and corrupt. They may be all those things. And they're in the gun sights. These are who took out Sadat in Egypt. They're who overthrew the government in Algeria and so on. So the enemy isn't always Washington and New York and the U.S. The enemy is often very near home. And I think one of the things we don't want to do in our action these days is to increase the size of those militant and terrorist movements and lose the support of the governments elsewhere who are quite open to participating in our attempt to isolate and reach and punish the terrorists.
In the way that we've talked about this, what happened last week and other things like it, I think that Muslims have complained, and rightly so, with some justification, that it seems to be almost the only case that we couple religious affiliation with the acts that we're talking about. And it seems that what we're dealing with here are acts that are largely political acts. And actually, as I think about it, it may be, in fact, that they are apolitical acts, not religious ones. How does one disentangle the political intent from the faith of the person committing the act?
The fact that what you said is true, that we don't usually associate religion with the others, is our nearsightedness, not their doing. There's hardly a day going by we don't see the word Protestant and Catholic in the news of Northern Ireland. Now, this is not the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church. They've had leaders. They've had women who win Nobel Prizes for trying to reconcile across these boundaries. But these things, these marches start in churchyards and end in them. They start and end with prayer. They invoke all of these things. Nigeria is torn between Muslim and Christian, and Christians are fighting rough there too and have to. Gush Emunim in Israel is responsible for a lot of the West Bank building and meet all the criteria we did study under fundamentalism, and they're have good weapons and good weaponry and so on. So I think the first thing we have to say is it's all over the place. But now the other point of your question, how do you discern and disentangle? You don't totally disentangle. Most movements are not somebody gets up in the morning and says, I believe in God this way, now I got to shoot at somebody. In most cases, it's attached to something else. In the present case, evidently, resentment, revenge, envy, and so on, just takes over, and Allah, in this case, for the bin Laden, assuming he's the main one, very clear in his talk that Allah is a big factor, and it has to be seen as religious when you notice that whatever we know about these people, they have a promise of instant access to paradise. If you're going to flight school and simulator school for months after months after months and lining up credit cards and lining investments because you're going to bash into a building, you better have thought through what you're doing, and they've thought through that this is Allah's will. So religion is in it just as it is so many other places. Hmm.
What is it the case that with the various fundamentalisms that you have studied and you talked a little bit about it right at the very beginning, do they all have in common this notion to put it very bluntly, that we're right and everybody else is wrong?
Yes, you have to have that. And that's what they don't like about conservatives and traditionalists. American Protestant fundamentalism, which is by no means the largest movement. Most conservative Protestants in America call themselves evangelical or Pentecostal, and they're not quite over into this camp. But when it was formed in the 1920s, the word was invented in July of 1921. In a Baptist magazine when somebody said, in our denominations, everybody wants to be conservative, but they won't fight for the Lord. We need a new word to say we've got the fundamentals of the faith and we are reacting, we're fighting for the Lord, and we know what we're doing. When Billy Graham says, I don't know, it's a little harder to fight for the Lord that way, and that's why he's friendly to so many religions, that real American fundamentalists. I have a book by American fundamentalists who say the biggest enemy of the faith in America in the last 50 years has been Billy Graham, who could agree with every one of their doctrines, but is moderate. So, yes, you have to have that sense that that God is guiding you. That's why I think that it's easier to be fundamentalist in the monotheistic religions, where there's a clear scripture. There's a boundary to Quran and Sharia. There's a boundary to Hebrew scriptures and New Testament. But in Hinduism, you don't have the boundaries of the scripture. There are all kinds of scriptures, and still you will take on the Muslims in the name of your gods or whatever. You have to be sure you know where history is going. You can know that you are the agent of God to affect God's purposes in history, and without that, it would fall apart.
Yeah. Well, that makes it, you know, I think some people honestly have said, well, you know, maybe we wouldn't... We wouldn't have so much conflict in the world if we could just get everybody, and not metaphorically, but in a way, everybody literally to sit down. We'll sit down around a big table. We'll talk. We'll get to know each other. We'll work out our differences. If a lot of the people who are coming to the table come to it with this attitude that says my way or the highway, then can such a discussion actually take place?
In the end, no. But that doesn't mean other discussions aren't worthwhile. When you identified me with the Park Ridge Center for the Study of Health, Faith, and Ethics, where we study the religious role in understanding sexuality, the life cycle, abortion, in vitro fertilization, euthanasia, whatever. And we know that on many of these issues, you can get all kinds of people to sit down and hear each other. But if you have an absolutist fundamentalist there, no, it doesn't pay. So what you have to do is get all the people who are open to hearing the other to do it. And I've chaired a number of sessions. I chaired the House of Representatives office building one day. They said invite 26 people to the table who, quote, can't stand each other. Gay and straight, Planned Parenthood versus anti-abortion or whatever. And the only rule of the game was you talk in the room to each other, not about each other. And there were a lot of painful things, but they had to look in each other's eyes and so on. Now, no pro-life person stopped being pro-life that day. It was none of our business to do that. But she looked into the eyes of Planned Parenthood and they never met each other. They never knew each other. So I think we often assume that people can't be reached. But once you're utterly in that camp, the word we would use is fanatic or something like that. No, you can't dislodge them. You have to turn that over to history and God and circumstance. A lot of people leave these movements. In America, the huge move from extremely militant fundamentalism into the moderate evangelical movements occur because if you want power, you moderate. If you want to change Supreme Courts, you hang out with a lot of moderates and elect a president who you think will appoint people there. Well, that's not pure fundamentalism anymore. You may have that theme, but you're hanging out with all kinds of people that you'd think are kind of smelly otherwise.
Mm. It's in some people's minds, they would say that here the point we are is if you're going to choose a philosophy, a set of guiding principles, something to live by, we're at this point where we seem to be invited to choose between extremes, between fundamentalisms, perhaps on the one hand, and between postmodernism or something like that on the other. Or maybe, I guess, there would be a few humanists hanging out in the corner somewhere who would think that they were, well, somewhere else. I think that leaves a lot of people feeling that they don't know where to go because they're not comfortable with fundamentalisms, but they're also not comfortable with postmodernism. And they say, Okay, where is there for me?
I'm one of them. You said it very nicely. For a picture I use, the word in America used these years, this is not globally, but America, is culture wars. I always have an image of the culture war in a landscape in which there are two mesas and a huge valley between. And 5 to 10% of the people are on those two mesas, and that's where the artillery is going. And an awful lot of the other people go in the light of where the last shells fell. You know, I think I'm with a camp, and then I hear them, and then I run off the other side a little bit, and that's the vast majority. And that's healthy. That means we're a pluralist society with a lot of voices and a lot of choices. Let's take an instance. Around the world, there are 1 billion Catholics, 1,000 million. They have a very, very traditionalist pope and current leadership. But it's not fundamentalist, because Catholicism officially defines itself as development of doctrine. And you can't be fundamentalist if the fundamentals can be adapted to change. The vast majority of Protestants, 25% of America identifies with what we call mainline Protestant. They're not all up there in the pew every Sunday, but that's where they identify. And there are no fundamentalists among them. The group I've called evangelical, these are not people that are totally unopen to other kinds of things. So we haven't had enough of that kind of voice. And at the core of that, I think, is the ability to have profound conviction of your own and the ability to listen to the other. So strong conviction that you might be tempted to be intolerant. I don't think the world prospers from wishy-washiness. But the gift, the most profound people of the past century, John the 23rd and Martin Luther King and Dorothy Day and Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Mohandas Gandhi, I can make a list of the top 20. Everyone is deeply identified with a religious voice. And every one of them was capable of forming coalitions with others and appealing to others. Martin Luther King is incomprehensible, apart from being a Black Baptist pastor. And he couldn't have made a move if he didn't have the rabbis, nuns, ministers, and lay leaders of the religions and plenty of good agnostics at his side. He didn't lose his conviction by doing that, but he gave the world one more model of how you can effect change in the world without loss of conviction.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Martin Marty, he is emeritus professor of history, of the history of modern Christianity at Divinity School at the University of Chicago. And as I mentioned, is the author of many books, over 50, dealing with religion and its place in American life, including the three-volume Modern American Religion, published by University of Chicago Press. He's also associated with the Park Ridge Center for the Study of Health, Faith, and Ethics. He's contributing editor of the Christian Century. He has been affiliated with University of Chicago since 1963. Before that, he served for a decade as a Lutheran parish pastor. He was ordained into the ministry in 1952. And he is here on the campus to give a talk. This is the 11th Annual Mortensen Distinguished Lecture this afternoon in the Colwell Playhouse at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts at 4 o'clock. And anyone interested in hearing him here in and around Champaign-Urbana is welcome to attend. It's open to the public.
I have to say thanks to my host for setting it at 4, because I just heard that President Bush is talking to joint session of Congress at 8, and I would hate to be lecturing at 8 o'clock during that.
That would have been difficult. So that indeed works out well.
Yeah.
Here we have someone else with question, comment, something to share with us here on In-Urbana, line 1.
Hello.
Yes.
Since the inherent quality of religion is divisiveness, which has caused war throughout the world's history, can you envision an enlightenment where the world became secular and what that might be like?
Yes, I can. I can envision it, but it isn't going to happen. That is, the world is very, very, very full of religious people, and more so all the time. The world was 1/7 Muslim in 1950. It's 1/5 Muslim today. Around the world, Christianity is holding at its 33%, and the more intense forms of it have been growing. Judaism is statistically quite small, but it is very dedicated in its various forms to its own common purposes. So it isn't going to go away, so it's kind of futile to ask that. But I think the other thing to do is to say, and now it's very delicate because some people will mishear me, so I have to make very clear, I believe that you can be a good citizen. I believe that you can be a great agent of democratic and republic life without belief in God, very, very much so, and we don't honor that enough. But I don't picture over the long pull a whole society is going to it. And the other thing is, if you leave a vacuum, you might get something worse. The one thing about the religions, for your very first sentence, they are divisive, but they all have in them a final vision of shalom, of peace, of reconciliation, to which they're working. They're working with very frail, broken timber of humanity, which messes it up, but that's their goal. And there have been numbers of efforts in the last century to go godlessly. And they got isms named too, and they were Stalinism and Leninism and Maoism and Nazism.
Buddhism.
Well, Buddhism. I have no problem with Buddhism. It doesn't. It doesn't have to say God, but it says the sacred and the spiritual. But it wasn't winning during the century, and so these 100 million member movements in which God wasn't allowed didn't give us a lot of encouragement that the world would be better off if you got rid of the gods and the God followers.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Other good questions,
question.
Comments are welcome. 333-WILL. Toll-free 800-222-WILO. One, in my listening over the many days here to the so many voices talking about what happened last week, I was really struck by someone, and now I don't know who it was, but someone who said that we have been a nation obsessed by the trivial. It certainly seems to be the case that one of the responses that people have had to last week's events was to really start reflecting on what is important, what really matters. And I wonder whether you think if indeed we're starting to question our obsession with the trivial and start thinking about what matters, whether that's something that will stay with us or that it's temporary and after, who knows, a month, 6 months, a year, we'll be right back where we were.
America, in its mentality, moves, I like to think of, in two ways, glacially and seismically. That is, glacially, we move the way glaciers move all the time, imperceptibly, but we're moving. And seismically, big shocks come and things happen. The Civil War, the Great Depression, the Second World War, the Vietnamese War, now this. And then there's a shock. Now, these two interplay with each other. Immediately after the shock, you do nothing but talk about the shock. I have no doubt that the campus chaplains at the University of Illinois saw every pew filled last Sunday, and they'd be very naive to think that they're going to be that way a year from now or 2 years from now, because that's just not how it works when the earthquake's over. It will be some increase, and certainly more increase in seriousness and in search for consolation and direction. There's no doubt about it. That's part of the glacial move. But they're all smart enough to know that no matter what, you don't sustain the intensity of the moment. So I think the question is going to be asked, what will be the nature of the glacial change this time? And I do think that the fundamental fact of the current one is we're never, never going to be able to sit back in apparent security the way we thought we could even months ago. Anybody who knew anything about terrorism knew we shouldn't be secure then, but we thought we were. And I know the background of what you're saying in trivia, in entertainment, in a lot of campus life, directionlessness, what do I want to do? Do I want to do anything at all? Apathy. And this is a great clearer of the mind. You better ask what use you want to make of your life. So the number of serious people, I think, is going to grow. Now, let me say, on the other hand, a little good word for trivia. It depends on whose trivia. That is, there are kinds of trivia that are terribly terrible. But I think it's very important in the midst of crises that the humble gestures go on. You keep having parties. You're not dancing on graves when you're doing a party. You're not capitulating. I think it's I'm not going to speak for binge drinking on campus, but I think camaraderie, collegiality is good. I think writing little email love letters to each other looks like trivia. But that's the network of the things that make valuable what we're fighting for. Now, there's bad trivia and good trivia, but I don't think that we serve the cause well by thinking that everything has to be grim. One of the things I haven't liked this week is that some people are measuring how patriotic you are by how brutally muscular macho you can sound. You know, that if I say kill them all, blast them all, Lance Morrow in the back of Time magazine, I thought was a terribly offensive editorial, and was saying, you got to hate. There's enough hate out there already. What we need is clarity of thinking to keep them in focus, to get them, but I don't think you do better for that. And the other thing is that you're measured by who's most enthusiastic as a flag waver. Flag is beautiful. I love to see them all over the place, but I don't think you're more the patriot by if you make an idol out of it and so on. So the trivial little gestures, the other things alongside the flag and the call up to service and the airport screening and the attempt to get bin Laden, I'd like to see them kept on too.
All right, let's go on to Champaign. Another caller here, line two. Hello.
Good morning. First of all, Professor Marty, I want to thank you for coming to Champaign-Urbana and being on this program. I would like to ask you if you think there's any possibility that these terroristic fundamentalist movements could be discredited, particularly to their followers.
The inner core followers, I wouldn't bet on, because there you have your whole life investment. You take no signals except those that are given by the group. 20 years ago in America, when what we call new religious movements and others called cults were around, you heard how hard it would be to talk one of James Jones's people out or Heaven's Gates people out or any of the people that are that far over. I don't use the word brainwash, but they live in a mentally furnished apartment that has no windows. And they're not going to change. But there are just tremendous numbers of people, and that's why I think our strategies have to be after, who can be reached by them if we're not careful, or we can drive people to them if we're not careful. And yes, there are great numbers of conservative and fundamentalist Muslims who can be won over. And a good case would be Iran. Best knowledge we have, I think, is that probably 80% of the people of Iran would like a far more productive society, a more republic society. The leadership strains some of it to move toward that, but is held back. Well, we have to make it easy for them to make that kind of move. And that's a kind of a conversion, not from Islam, but into its interactive, dialogical mode. So I don't despair of that. A lot of hardliners don't stay hardline when some of the things disappear. But for the inner core, the people we're after, I really would not be optimistic about seeing many of them won over.
So you seem to be saying that the only way to be free of them is for them to die.
I have to, well, they either have to die or lose their weaponry. They have to be so isolated that it's futile. They have to, the money supply has to be cut off, weapon supply cut off. You know, if there are 10 or 20 or 30,000 of them around the world, I don't think you can go up in every cave and find them and shoot them and kill them. But I think you can do something to neutralize a good deal of their force, but not on the short range. I have to agree with the folks who are running this. It's going to be long, long.
The best we can hope for is not to be safe, but to be safer.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. And let's go to another call here. This is Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Marty. I have, within the last few years, changed from being a Protestant to becoming Orthodox. We have a mutual friend, Father Gregory Rogers, I believe.
Yes, indeed.
And anyway, in so doing, I've discovered another view on Middle Eastern politics. In my evangelical days, I was tended to be pretty pro-Israel. But since then, as I've met people from other cultures, Middle Eastern cultures, I've heard the other side of the story. I wonder if you could speak to why, in America in particular, we tend to be more pro-Israel than the traditional Christian peoples in the Middle East would be.
All right.
I'll hang up and listen.
Good. I'll start where you start and say that great numbers of Christians, Mennonites, Lutherans, almost anybody who works with the Palestinian Christians, has been very, very critical of the policies in Israel and have sided with the dissenters in Israel, who until 2 years ago or so were a much stronger force than they are today. So there are all kinds of such voices, and I know the Orthodox Christians in Israel also have that. Most of them are Israelis and want to be, but they don't like the policies. To the point of your question, why so many line up the way they do on the stronger theme, I think you'd have to say that the ones who are most militant have a particular biblical interpretation, which Jews themselves don't share, and most Catholics, most Protestants, and most Orthodox don't share, and that is that Israel can do anything it wants because it has to exist a certain way or else Jesus won't come again. That's not really what a Jew wakes up in the morning in Israel waiting for, but that's what American premillennial, dispensational, tribulational, raptural fundamentalists, to give the whole name, do. Now, statistically, they're not huge, but they're producing the Left Behind movies and things, which become New York Times bestsellers. So that's one core. A larger number is when I'm brought up in my Lutheran Sunday school or Catholic parochial school, The childhood map of Israel was Dan to Beersheba and Mediterranean to the Jordan, and that's a sort of an instinct. Third, it is a democracy. It may not be quite our style, but it is someone we identify with. Fourth, there's a strong sense of, after the Holocaust, this was a people that had been denied a nation, and so we have to do things with it. I think any time American Jews, Christians, or anybody else give a free ride to everything Israel wants to do, we exacerbate the problem, and therefore we have to hear many of the voices, and you're describing some of them.
I'll try to squeeze at least one more person here, line two, Urbana. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
I realize that Professor Marty's focus is fundamentalism this morning, but I would point out that when it comes to terrorists, they're not all fundamentalists, nor are they all of one strain where they are fundamentalists. That we've had as much trouble with our own homegrown right-wing terrorists, Timothy McVeigh and what was Smith's name. But anyway, what I was going to say is there's one common thread. If you can remove the issues which bring people to support them. In the Middle East, of course, the Israeli-Jordanian problem is one. There are others. What is seen as our bullying or exploiting the third world is another. You decrease the support for the terrorist element of the fundamentalists. Actually, we can live quite nicely with fundamentalists. I may not agree with them, but they're good people, most of them.
Indeed. Well, I certainly agree. The fundamentalist down the block, the one who's running the computer, the one that's in my classroom, the one that's my neighbor, I don't worry about them one little bit. And I like the point you make that not all terrorism is religious fundamentalism. The Kaczynskis and the McVeighs and others you mention, Saddam Hussein, I see as a terrorist, and he tried to call it a jihad or a holy war, and to their credit, most Muslims didn't bite because they don't see him as being fundamentally religious. You can be terrorist on many grounds. I do like your point that you do everything you can to remove the circumstances that give them legitimacy, which means generous foreign policies, generous foreign aid, real attempt to be close to people. A lot of Americans have done that. But when they move beyond that, when they use God as legitimation for terrorism, as I say, it's too late in the game. I don't think anything we would do to try to build up a wonderful economy in Afghanistan today would produce bin Laden. I think our policy of now trying to woo Pakistan shows we're going to have to give them foreign aid. There's got to be some dollar sign attached to the things we're doing there. And I'm all for that. The more friends we have, the better off we are, and we'll take away the circumstances out of which these things grow. So thanks for a good question.
And there we'll have to stop because we're here at the end of the time for people in and around Champaign-Urbana. If you'd like to hear more from our guest, Martin Marty, he'll be giving a talk. It's the 11th Annual Mortenson Distinguished Lecture on the U of I campus this afternoon, 4 o'clock in the Colwell Playhouse of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Martin Marty is Professor Emeritus of the History of Modern Christianity at University of Chicago. Thank you very much.
Good to be with you.